Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On May Day in 2006, millions of immigrants across the United States went on strike in what they called a day without immigrants. And then 8 years later, more than 100,000 people demonstrated to demand an end to police brutality under the banner of Black Lives Matter. In 2015, more than 60,000 workers in over 200 cities took to the streets to demand better pay and the right to unionize as part of the Fight for 15. And they have been wildly successful. Today's guest, Tamara Drought, says taken together, these three movements represent a major surge in organizing of, by, and for the new working class, a sleeping giant that is organizing and fighting for better working conditions. So who are the new working class, and what do their struggles say about the shifting economic landscape in the United States? In her new book, Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America, Tamara Drought gives a voice to the new working class, the largest group of workers who are mostly invisible in the U.S. media, and they're not really being talked about in the political debates. Tamara Drought is Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos, a public policy organization that is working to reduce political and economic inequality. Her last book is Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead, and her new book is Sleeping Giant. And Tamara Drought joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Hi, Tamara. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So let's start off with the dedication of your book. You dedicate your book to your father, who worked as a machinist at a steel factory for 29 years. And it got me thinking about those of us who grew up who are Gen Xers, right? A lot of us had parents who had really good union jobs. A lot of our parents learned trades, and yet they were able to buy one or maybe two houses and put their kids through school. So tell us a little bit about your dad and why you decided to dedicate this book to him.
Sure. Well, as you said, he worked at a steel factory, and my mom was an office manager at the local orthodontist office. And together, you know, they were able to raise me and my three siblings in middle-class comfort on, you know, what back then were working-class jobs. And, you know, it wasn't just that, you know, we could have the middle-class luxuries like taking a yearly family vacation. You know, things that today aren't possible for this new service sector working class. We always had enough food in the house. Mm. My parents were able to save enough money so that when it was time for me to go to college, they were able to pay full freight, room, board, and tuition at a state university. So I left without any college debt, which is unheard of today. Mm. And so I wanted to dedicate it to him because I think he passed away almost 3 years ago. That he recognized what had been stripped away from workers, both in terms of their dignity and in terms of the amount that they were getting paid for their labor, and saw it as a real tragedy and a real decline in a bedrock American principle, which is, you know, if you do the work, it should be valued and it should be enough to keep your family in comfort.
And as you write in your book, the working class definition has really changed. And it's so interesting because in most of the political debates, you hear middle class over and over again. You rarely hear working class. So tell us about how the meaning of working class has really changed over time.
Yeah, thank you. The working class, you know, has kind of disappeared from our lexicon. It creeps back in every 4 years when we're just overwhelmingly, you know, during a presidential election, talking about white working class men. That's pretty much the only time in our discourse we hear about the working class. So a couple things are new about this new working class. Unlike sort of folks like my dad, you know, who were mostly white, mostly male, worked in industrial jobs, this new working class is much more racially diverse and much more female. And it's shifted from making stuff to serving people. So those two things, both the idea of service and serving people, as well as the people doing the work, have led to a real marginalization and undervaluing of this new working class. And I think the fact that it's more female and more people of color, and the fact that it's doing jobs of the serving and caring of people, is a major reason why it has seen its political visibility shrink considerably in the last couple decades.
And you write that one of the main reasons is because mostly white individuals were able to educate their way out of the working class.
That's exactly right. We have we've made gains in college attainment, but those gains have been much larger for white people in this country than for Latinos, Asians, or African Americans. And so the result is we now have both because of demographic change and because of the ability to take advantage of the opportunity to get a college degree, we have a working class that is much more female and more people of color. The other thing to note is that the young working class, those who are 25 to 34, is almost 50% people of color.
Wow.
So it is just vital at this time that we really address the structural racism and sexism that have led to the reality that today the jobs that are adding the most to our economy, healthcare jobs, fast food, retail, janitorial services, childcare work, are predominantly done by women and by people of color, and they are the lowest paid positions in our economy.
You know, and what I loved about your book is that you interviewed so many people, and I feel like when we talk about these issues, we spend so much time on the statistics, which are really important, and we'll definitely talk about those today, but you really gave a voice to these workers. And so many people you interviewed and people we've had on this show say that they feel completely disrespected. I'll never forget interviewing a woman about 50s or 60s who's a cashier at Walmart. And she said, you know, I'd really love a raise, but what I would love even more than that is to once in a while be told that I did a good job today. She said, I just feel like I'm not even seen at work.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out in a lot of your interviews.
It did. In fact, no matter what the occupation, this issue of not feeling valued or respected on the job just was rampant. It was universal with people I spoke to. And, you know, the reality is that it's true. You know, if you think about what has happened to working class jobs in this country, disrespect has really become baked into them. You know, we have the reality that employers can now, you know, yank people day to day, schedule them different hours, different days of the week, week to week. You know, the federal minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 for a very long time. These jobs provide very little benefits. And then we have frontline supervisors who have so much power and wield it so arbitrarily to make conditions on the job just really awful. And the thing that I think is saddest about this is that this is really juxtaposed to the great value and pride that these workers take in the job that they're doing, whether it's being a sales associate at Walmart in the electronics department or being a commercial sanitation driver in Atlanta, Georgia. People take great value from the work they do. And when that isn't at all reciprocated, either on the job or in our political system or in our culture, they sense it. You know,
right.
They're right. They are invisible. They've been invisible for a very long time. And I think we need to change that. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, is really lift up how important the working class are, and that if we don't really dedicate ourselves to improving job quality and the living standards, we will never get to a place where we all feel economically secure in this country.
So to go back to statistics for a minute, you write that the working class are people who are in the labor market but don't have four-year college degrees. And that's two-thirds of all Americans?
That is. I know. People are shocked. People with college educations are shocked when they hear that statistic. That's the reality. I mean, America has always been a working class nation. We are still a working class nation. Two-thirds of people in the workforce don't have four-year college degrees. And unlike a generation ago with my dad and my mom, we have not committed ourselves to ensuring that you can still have a good job in this country without a college degree. And that is something that we need to dedicate ourselves to just as much as we are dedicating ourselves to making college more affordable.
Well, right. And at a time when college is becoming even more unaffordable, so many of these people that you're writing about maybe want to go to college, but in some cases, a lot of people can't afford community college these days.
Absolutely. I mean, the cost of community college has doubled in the last two decades. And, you know, they still have cost of living. So that just covers tuition. Then you have books and fees, not to mention, you know, often rent and food and transportation that you need to take care of. So at the same time that we've let the job quality for occupations that don't require college degrees just, you know, fall off a cliff, at the same time, our political leaders have been cutting state funding of public universities and colleges. So people are really between a rock and a hard place. They can't afford to get a degree that will is now a necessity for a good paying job. It's not a guarantee, but it's a necessity at this point. We've really created no way for the working class to be able to, you know, not only meet their needs, but meet their dreams and the dreams of their kids. And that, to me, is fundamentally such an American value. And to see how much we have degraded so many millions and millions of jobs in this country is alarming. And I hope that as we move towards the general election, we will see, you know, the needs of this new working class much more front and center in the political campaign.
So the new working class is the service sector working class. As you said, we've shifted from making stuff to basically serving people. And you point out that the demographics are African-American, Latino, a lot more women. And so tell us about some of these jobs. We're talking sanitation workers, home health care workers. What else?
Sure. So, you know, if you think about what are the 10 largest jobs in this country in terms of what are the occupations that are adding the most jobs every year, year after year, and will be adding the most jobs for the next 10 years. They are primarily jobs that don't require any training beyond high school. They require very little on-the-job training. And they are fast food jobs, they're retail jobs, they're customer service jobs, they're home health care and child care jobs, and janitorial jobs. As well as just general sort of manual labor jobs in warehouses. These are sort of the backbone of our economic growth. And we have really, you know, in some ways shot ourselves in the foot because right now this working class has so much latent purchasing power that could help the economy grow if we had a higher federal minimum wage and if we actually had employers take some responsibility to upgrade the quality of these jobs.
So when you're talking about fast food, retail, home health care, janitorial, these jobs cannot be automated, right?
Exactly. And that's I guess, the beauty in some way is that we can – these are jobs that aren't at risk of being offshored. And, you know, I would never not say that we shouldn't try to bring manufacturing jobs back to this country, especially, you know, the daughter of a steelworker. But we spend a lot of time talking about how are we going to bring back manufacturing and very little time talking about how we are going to improve the jobs that are already here and already growing in this country and aren't at risk of being offshored.
Well, it's such a good point. And I bring up automation because we had Robert McChesney on our show on Tuesday. And based on what he has heard from very high-level CEOs, over the next maybe two decades, we are going to face the possibility of losing about 50% of jobs in this country because of advanced technology, automation, and, you know, basically technology is going to take away these jobs, and we're really not having that conversation either. Did that come up in your research?
No, not too much. And you know, I think that we do have to prepare for more technological change. I'm not yet convinced that we're looking at 50% job loss, but if that's the fact, if that's the case, we definitely need to do something and do something serious now, which I think is why you're seeing a bubbling of interest in this idea of a guaranteed basic income.
Right.
That said, that's still two decades, right, that these jobs are going to remain here. And that's a generation. That's another lost generation of parents who won't be able to keep enough food in the cupboards, to not be able to fill up the tank to get to work, and pay the rent on time. And that's the reality that working class families have today is, you know, Google just announced they're no longer going to accept ads from the payday lending industry. You know, the whole reason the payday lending industry exists is because wages and benefits have fallen so far below what they used to be that this new working class is relying on credit cards and payday lending to make ends meet.
Today, we're speaking with Tamara Drought, Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos, a public policy organization that is working to reduce political and economic equality. Her newest book is Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. And in this book, she gives a voice to the new working class. This is the largest group of workers, and they're mostly invisible in the media, and they're really not coming up in the presidential debate, although we will talk to you, ask you a couple questions, Tamara, about some working class voters who have been drawn to the Donald Trump campaign, for example. But if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you consider yourself working class, if you work in the service sector, again, fast food, retail, home health care, child care, janitorial, what has your experience been like? Are you able to make ends meet? And what do you think about this growing group of workers in this country? So many of them would like to work full time and they can't. They don't want to be on food stamps, but they have no choice. So what are your thoughts on this? And what about solutions? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, morning, Rose and Tamara. Yeah, I wanted to ask about whether or not she's included some of the alternative currencies that people are coming up with. People are familiar with Bitcoin and whatnot, but there are other people that have come up with smaller types of barter systems. And I guess as a side kind of question, the valuation of our lives has always been a kind of a trap. There was the ancient three estates. We hear about the press as the fourth estate, but that's based upon the ancient three estates, the king, the military, and the church, who had their different kinds of pecking orders, and that the little guy was never able to live up to the pecking orders of the ancient three estates. And so the press, as the fourth estate, came up with the truth that could be written down and history could be developed by maintaining some view on all of this. So the idea of coming up with a valuation for our lives and how this future is unfolding is a big part of that. Had you included any of that in your book?
Great question. Yes, I have a whole chapter in the book called The Privilege of Visibility, and one section of that chapter talks about the role of the media and this invisibility of this new working class. I specifically look at some research that tracked how the Great Recession was covered in mainstream media, and what's so upsetting is that even an economic calamity was not enough to really propel what was happening to the working class, who honestly, you know, were losing homes, losing jobs at a rate much greater than the professional class. They weren't the subject of most of the stories. And in fact, you know, two elite papers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, you know, focused on how the falls from grace. The Washington Post ran like a 7,000-word article with the headline, Barely Making It on $300,000.
Wow.
Right. This is the Washington Post. It matters what they talk about because, you know, that's sort of the, de rigueur reading for anybody who works on Capitol Hill.
Yep.
And even throughout the whole recession, most of the coverage was about the big banks, a lot about the auto deal, but not about the auto deal from sort of a worker perspective, but from a political horse race. You know, is this going to hurt Obama? Is this going to help him? Blah, blah, blah. And so even during the Great Recession, the working class was invisible. Now, what I will say is that is changing, and it's changing because of the fight for 15. Mm. You know, to garner some visibility in the New York Times, we had a great piece from Jody Cantor, who did a great investigative piece looking at the lives of a barista at Starbucks. which led to Starbucks saying it would get much better about its scheduling practices the day after that article ran. Mm. But, you know, as much as I don't want to admit this, I don't think that article would have been written if we hadn't had hundreds of thousands of people hitting the streets over the last couple years demanding a better wage and the right to a union. You know, that has caused more and more media to pay attention to the real experiences of this new working class, and that's a good thing.
Right. I mean, in 2015, we had 60,000 workers in over 200 cities, fast food workers, taking to the streets to demand better pay. A lot of them refused to go to work. And a lot of people, when Governor Cuomo of New York signed legislation enacting a statewide $15 minimum wage after saying he opposed it, said that the op-ed he wrote in the New York Times could have been written by an activist, and that just showed what sort of impact this movement has had.
Absolutely. This movement, I mean, it's only been around for 3 years, which is incredible. And we now have our two biggest states with the biggest economies, New York and California, who have passed legislation to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And in the book, I interview somebody at the SEIU who's been, you know, working on some of the strategy of the fight for 15. And, you know, he was telling me about how when they first started going around and talking to people, they would get laughed out of the room. And this is by, you know, progressives, because the idea of a $15 wage was, at the time, just too audacious. You know, it was seen as, like, crazy. But here we are now. It's become the benchmark. It's become the demand. And it's not only been a demand, it's now legislation and law in an increasing number of states and cities. And I think that what gives me hope is that we do have these new movements of the new working class who are actually making real change happen. And I think success is contagious. And the more that we see that the power of the people hitting the streets and holding politicians accountable, that is working, the more people will join these movements and support these movements and continue to make the case for change.
Before we go to break, Tamara, what else did you learn about the fight for 15? How were they able to mobilize so many people so quickly and see so many successes so quickly?
Well, you know, they had funding from the SEIU, which has been critical. But I think you really have to give the credit to the workers who you know, without the backing of a union, are risking losing their jobs. And they did it. And they brought a lot of people along with them. I think one of the successes have been that it originally began as mostly a fast food campaign, but it has broadened out to include home care workers, adjunct faculty, retail workers, and fast food workers. And together, that banding and solidarity across jobs, across sectors, has been really, really important.
And what is the current status of the fight for 15? And what are their plans from here on out?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, we just had not too long ago, again, another unprecedented day of action. I think the goal is to continue to get legislation passed in more states and more cities to fight back against. You know, now what we're seeing is states, particularly conservative states, are passing laws that basically say that cities within their state don't have the right to raise the minimum wage to a higher level than the state minimum wage. So I think, you know, they're going to stay at it and particularly stay focused on making sure that this issue remains central to the presidential debate that we're engaged in right now.
Tamara Drought is author of the new book, Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. The new working class is now the service working class. And we're talking about who these people are and then the movements to increase their wages and their quality of life. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
We'll be right back. We'll be right back to Your Call. After just a momentary break, I'm Matt Martin here with Malihe Razazan, producer of this program, thanking people who have supported local public radio in the last couple of days and asking for your support at 800-525-9917. Thanks to Betty Dvorsen, a longtime supporter in San Francisco who gave her support, and Laura Sims in San Francisco who just went to KALW.org to support local public radio.
And Matt, Our listeners can click donate at klw.org or call 1-800-525-9917 to get a copy of Sleeping Giants, How the New Working Class Will Transform America by our today's guest, Tamara Drought. And as she was talking with Rose about how American working class been the backbone of this economy, I was thinking that for the past 75 years, our listeners, loyal listeners, new listeners, they have been the backbone of this station. And that's why we have taken the day today to thank you for listening, to thank you for engaging with us, to thank you for supporting us with your emails and calls, and now with your financial support. 1-800-525-9917. And you can always go and click donate and pledge securely online at kalw.org.
800-525-9917 or kalw.org. If you go to the website, you can see Tamara Drought's new book, Sleeping Giant. It's yours for a $120 contribution to KALW. 800-525-9917. We will thank you for your support. Every single person makes a difference at any level of support. We appreciate you becoming involved with local public radio and supporting your call. Thanks.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Tamara Drought. She's Vice President of Policy and Research at DEMOS, a public policy organization that's working to reduce political and economic inequality. Her latest book is Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. She writes that the new working class is the service sector working class. It shifted from making stuff to serving people. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have one of these jobs, whether it's fast food, janitorial, home health care, child care, retail, we'd love to hear your story. How are you treated at work? Are you able to make ends meet? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Tamara tells the story of so many people who have these jobs who say that they feel disrespected and completely ignored, and that politicians are not trying to earn their vote because they're really not talking about them. So speaking of politicians, Tamara, let's talk about how we got here, because there are Republican and Democratic policies that we can point to learn about how we got to this point where people are really struggling to make ends meet and they're working full time.
Yeah, great question. So I think before we get to the actual policies, one thing to talk about is a huge power shift that happened in this country, and that was really very carefully and deliberately and aggressively orchestrated by America's business leaders. And this happened coming on the heels of the 1960s, when we had the civil rights movement making progress. We had the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964. We had environmental activists getting wins in terms of new environmental protection laws like clean water. We had the anti-war activists. So a lot of this activism was directed at business, and business leaders really felt under attack and under threat. And so what they did was decide, based on a memo that was drafted 3 months before he became a Supreme Court Justice, Lewis Powell, wrote a memo to the Chamber of Commerce, basically laying out a blueprint for them to become a major political player and a lobbying, you know, powerful force in Washington, D.C. Before that, it was kind of, you know, mostly a sleepy trade association. And they listened. And what we saw was a huge growth in the amount of lobbying power in D.C. on behalf of businesses, in the amount of political action committees, PACs that were corporate sponsored. And so here we are today, and there are 24 business lobbyists for every member of Congress. That's 24 business lobbyists per member of Congress. And what has happened at the same time is we had the Supreme Court rule that money was actually free speech, constitutionally protected free speech. And so we've had the loosening of campaign finance regulations. And the result has been that today we have a donor class that is overwhelmingly white and male, who is really determining who gets to run for office, what are the policies and the priorities that are on the agenda, and ultimately, what are the policies that get enacted? You know, political scientists have now discovered what we all sort of knew in our gut, which is that most Americans have very little say about what policies get enacted in this country. And that is especially true for the working class. And it's especially true on economic policy issues. So just to give you one example, you know, if you look at the donor class, people who are overwhelmingly very, very wealthy, there's not even 50% support for raising the minimum wage high enough to keep a family out of poverty. That's something that the general public has, you know, supports at levels that, you know, reach 100%, you know, high 80s, mid 90s. People really believe that the minimum wage should be enough to keep a family out of poverty. But the donor class doesn't think that because it is overwhelmingly drawing from sort of the titans of business in this country. So all of that has created a climate where the interests of business and the relentless drive for short-term profits, which is driven by Wall Street, has resulted in just a total degradation of wages, of our safety net in terms of how robust and how generous it is, of spending at both the state and federal level that has resulted in a public infrastructure, including our educational system. And all of these things have sort of chipped away at all of our economic security, but particularly the economic security of the new working class.
Mm. And so tell us about some of the political changes you have seen under, for example, Nixon, Reagan, and then Clinton and Obama.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that also happened after the Civil Rights Act is Republicans who have always wanted to end public investment and government's role in the economy because they saw it as a real intrusion into free enterprise, realized that they could begin chipping away at support for government by making it seem like government was really only benefiting people who just got a seat at the table, right? Who just finally got some governmental protection, and that was African Americans. And so beginning with Nixon, we have the use of strategic racism in political campaigns. You know, Nixon campaigned on law and order and on states' rights. Then this method really got perfected with Ronald Reagan, who talked about welfare queens. And then Bill Clinton picked up the baton and talked about ending welfare as we know it. So essentially what has happened is support for government. You know, whites used to support government when they thought it helped people like them. You know, we have Medicare, Social Security, the GI Bill, all of that stuff. As soon as we had the Civil Rights Act, that changed. And in fact, Lyndon Johnson was the last Democratic candidate for president that got the majority white vote. So Dog Whistle Politics, which is the name of a fabulous book by Ian Hanny Lopez, who's also a Demos senior fellow, has really chipped away at the idea of government and this idea that government serves our common purpose. And by really chipping away at government's ability to work on behalf of the public interest, we have all been made worse off. But that worsening of our living standards has just clobbered the working class at a level that is really without comparison.
And then you have George W. who passed major, major tax cuts for the rich. And at the time we heard that those tax cuts would create jobs, we don't talk about those at all anymore. It's like he doesn't even exist anymore. President Obama extended some of those tax cuts. He also pushed free trade agreements like his predecessors. How did those trade, the sort of modern trade agreements, how are they affecting this group of people?
Well, they've certainly affected the old industrial working class. I mean, I think what we're seeing right now is a real tapping into the rightful anger and isolation that folks who previously, you know, my dad was the fifth generation drought to work at the steel plant he worked at. When that goes away, people feel a loss. You know, when you take something away, that's much more painful than if you've never had it. And a lot of the new working class who are overwhelmingly Latino and women and African American, they actually never had really gotten to the good stuff, to the good jobs, especially those high-paying trade and manufacturing jobs. And so the loss was experienced so much more heavily among the old industrial white working class because something literally was taken away, and those were family-sustaining jobs, factory jobs that they could pass down to their sons and, to a lesser extent, to their daughters. And I think tapping into that is what has made Donald Trump's campaign so successful. Unfortunately, there has been a pretty big vacuum left on the Democratic side, exactly as you said, in terms of Democrats adopting many of the neoliberal economic policies that conservatives championed from day one. And that includes trade deals, that includes tax cuts. And it's been devastating. It includes not really standing up full throttle in support of expanding the rights and protecting the rights of people to organize on the job. The reality is it is very hard to unionize a workplace today. The rules are overwhelmingly tilted towards employers. So we have a lot of work to do. And right now we have really neither party, neither of our two political parties, who are centering their economic and social platform around the needs of the majority of workers in this country, this new working class that we're talking about.
Tamara Drought is Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos, a public policy organization that works to reduce political and economic inequality. Her newest book is Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you work in one of these occupations like fast food, retail, even construction, hospitality, janitorial, we'd love to hear from you. Are you able to make ends meet? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Joe in San Francisco. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's Joel. I'm pretty much a lifetime retail employee, mostly from working from a corporate office. But one thing I want to bring to light is that the general public doesn't realize, most people don't realize, is the abuse that a lot of people take in the service sector, not from their employers, but actually from their customers who they have to work with. I've seen this in a number of different forms. It forms from verbal to physical, and it's just something that, you know, goes way beyond their pay scale. And it's just, I think, something that needs to be realized. And a lot of companies take this philosophy that the customer is always right. Hmm. I believe Nordstrom's started. And really, employees, sales associates on the floor, really have no backbone to stand up to some of these customers. Companies don't want to say you have the right to ask a customer to leave. And I've witnessed some pretty horrific things here in San Francisco. From, you know, this homeless people who, you know, are mentally ill and drug addicts coming into your store and just, you know, raising, you know, all kinds of problems, to shoplifters who, you know, you are to discourage, to give them, you are to give them customer service. But I've seen shoplifters actually, I've seen one actually hit an employee in the face. And I also witnessed one time shoplifters who pepper sprayed sales associates' eyes on the floor. And that's just one thing the public really doesn't realize, you know, the dangers of working, you know, with the public.
I see it on the bus for sure. Tamara, did this come up in some of your interviews?
Yes, absolutely. And I really want to thank Joel for raising this, because I think disrespect is not just limited to the bosses. And the one example that is really important to lift up, because it's related to a lot of advocacy efforts to change the wage, is around restaurant workers. Mm-hmm. People who are waiters and waitresses especially are often subject to levels of sexual harassment that, you know, are deplorable. And they're in a rock and a hard place because they have to give service with a smile in order to get a tip. So we are putting particularly restaurant workers in very awkward and often very offensive situations where they have to be nice in order to make a living. And this all goes back to the idea of a different minimum wage for workers who earn tips. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of smaller restaurants agree to throw out the idea of a tip minimum wage and just pay their workers $15 an hour, $17 an hour, because it really does create a very pernicious power dynamic often. You know, I waited tables for 4 years during my breaks on college, and it was not always the funnest job. There were often a lot of men who would act like they have known you for 15 years and expect you to play along and be friendly, and if you didn't, you wouldn't get your tip. So, you know, these the other thing I want to bring to the listeners is it's also as simple as, I don't know if you've experienced this, Rose, but you'll be in line at the drugstore, and maybe the person ahead of you has their earbuds in, and they don't even take their earbuds out. They don't even say hello. Mm. They don't even look at the cashier in the eyes, right? And I just think that is so disrespectful. I know we're all plugged in now, but just take out the earbuds and say hello to the person who's ringing you up.
Yep, you're right. In fact, in my neighborhood recently, I met this guy who was doing construction on this big Victorian, and he grew up in San Francisco and said, people walk down the street and they don't even acknowledge me. It's like I've got tools on my body and they don't really know what to do with me. He said, I feel like a stranger in my own town. I mean, as you know, things are changing so much in San Francisco, especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 I mean, it's that invisibility.
Right.
That people feel from all corners, from, you know, our culture. Their lives aren't reflected on TV anymore. From our politics, they're not talked about in our political debates. And in our economy, mm-hmm. you know, their work isn't valued. And you see that in the wages and the business practices.
Tamara Drought is author of Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. And let's go next to Ruby. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. I know I'm a dinosaur. I'm 70. But in the last century, we always worked part-time jobs at minimum wage. And your guest, Ms. Drought, has articulated what I think we've all come to accept, that you have to raise a family. I was so shocked to hear that. You have to raise a family on minimum wage. No, that is so wrong. I don't understand. It used to be teenagers working minimum wage, or really unskilled, uneducated workers who did not have a high school degree. They worked minimum wage. And even if you couldn't be in a union, you got increases based on merit. I'm just shocked that it has become so routine that we have accepted that minimum wage has to raise a family. It's so wrong. And I understand you've laid out the history, and it's really valuable to know that, but it's like a slap in the face, a bucket of water in the face. I am just blown away because it's true. Why is that? Didn't we all work part-time jobs at minimum wage when we were kids? It's for kids, and it's for... I'm so sad and frustrated.
Well, thank you, Ruby. And you make a good point, because the Economic Policy Institute has found that 88% of workers who would benefit from a higher minimum wage are older than 20. One-third are over 50. A lot of people over 20 and 30, I'm sorry, over 40, over 20 and 30 work in fast food jobs. And the average hourly wage in a fast food restaurant is $9. The average CEO pay, CEOs who own fast food joints, are, what, $27 million. Bloomberg had a piece, fast food CEOs make 1,000 times the pay of the average fast food worker.
Yeah, I think that was based on a Demos report we did, actually, looking at, it turns out that fast food has one of the largest pay gaps between CEOs and the average frontline worker. And that's really the result of just how low paying those jobs are. And I really appreciate Ruby calling in and sharing her sadness and frustration. Mm. She's exactly right. The typical minimum wage worker, or a worker earning just above minimum wage, is no longer a teenager. You know, it's no longer somebody who's just trying to, you know, me trying to raise living expenses when I was in college. It has become the, first of all, these are the jobs that are adding the most to our economy are in these low-paid sectors, like we've been discussing. And they often either pay minimum wage or right above minimum wage. And we have to remember, you know, 23 states, I think it's 23, States in this country don't have minimum wages that are higher than the federal. And our federal minimum wage is $7.25.
Mm. Well, thank you for calling in, Ruby. Let's go next to June in Oakland. Hi, June.
Hi. I just wanted to make a couple of comments because I have been working as an employment specialist for over 25 years. And so I wanted to say that what is happening is America wants a new slave. And that's why they are hiring people and they're creating jobs in the service industry. And I want to say that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton with that NAFTA agreement, which really hurt a lot of people. That really hurt a lot of people because they outsourced those jobs, and that's another reason. And I know that also, like, the young people are not gravitating to her because of the things that are going on, and they are very concerned about their future lives and the lives of their children. And also in Harlem, you know, she and Bill bought up Harlem, so they displaced a lot of African-American people there. And I also want to say, you know, people's lives are being devalued. And these people that are working in these service industries, all life has value. Martin Luther King said, you know, service is what we're supposed to be doing for each other.
Yep.
Fighting service for each other and being good to one another and loving each other. And I also know that Hillary Clinton had been asked a question about when she was young and her part in the civil rights movement. And her answer to that was, you know, she participated in it, and it was fun. Well, you know what? A lot of people lost their lives. And so what you're doing is you're diminishing what people did. People were killed in the civil rights movement. So, you know, that's why people are not gravitating to her, especially these young people. And they're just tired of it. You know, you have to get involved. My father was a Del Monte cannery worker, which was a seasonal job, and he also had a barbershop in the house. So we were able to you know, my thought, we had a secure home. Our parents loved us, took care of us. We were Christian people. And a lot of those things have just gone down the tube. America has gone to hell in a handbasket. Mm-hmm. And it's because these people who are in making policies and making laws and legislation against people, that's going to change. It has got to change, and I'm so glad to hear this young person and this lady talk about today, the sleeping giant, because people need to wake up.
Well,
you know what? They just want to be spoon-fed about what is happening, and they don't want to seek it out, pursue it, and go about it relentlessly to make sure that they're understanding what's happening to us in America.
Well, June, thank you so much, and people are definitely waking up. We see it, although you might not see it in other media. But Tamara, we've got a minute left. What about that? I mean, your book, Sleeping Giant, How the New mm-hmm. Working Class Will Transform America. People are waking up, and you've got...
They are.
Go ahead.
So thank you, June. I really appreciate it. And I actually just want to lift up one piece she said, because she said America wants a new slave. And one of the through lines in the book, one of the themes of the book, is just how profound racism is, particularly in explaining the degradation of mm-hmm. our jobs and the anti-government sentiment and the austerity agenda. And more than at least three individuals that I spoke to compared their jobs to slavery. Hmm. That should be a alarming wake-up call for all of us in America. We all need to really dedicate ourselves to undoing the legacy of the original sin of this country, which was slavery. We have not done that. And until we do, I don't think we will see the kind of progressive transformation that many people, and especially the young people that June mentioned, are advocating for.
Right. And Tamara, just quickly, we need to bring you back to talk about solutions because we're slammed with phone calls now. What's at the top of the top of your list for the changes you want to see?
So many.
I know.
I think it's really important that we focus on both our economy and our democracy. We have to get money out of politics. We mm-hmm. have to really strengthen and protect the freedom to vote, which, as June mentioned, people died for. And we have seen just a curtailing of voter rights, you know, these voter ID laws. So we have to focus on our democracy. And then we need to fundamentally do things like raise the minimum wage. We need to update our labor protection laws, which were designed for a new era, a different era. We need to invest in people. We need to invest in high-quality, affordable child care for every parent in this country, and we need to finally have paid family leave. These are issues that keep working class and even middle class people up at night, and it is time that we really recommit to caring for each other, all people in this country, through investing in our common good. Mm. And that is what our government should be about.
Well, Tamara Drought, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your work on this. As I said, we couldn't get to calls. We had full lines, and we'll definitely bring you back. Tamara Drought is author of Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. Thank you, Tamara.
Thank you, Rose. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm joined now in studio by General Manager Matt Martin.
You know, I was just impressed, Rose, hearing... I was impressed hearing the callers in this hour, the passion,
yes,
the sense that this is information, these are ideas, these are problems that we face as a society that matter. And it is that opportunity for engagement around these conversations that matter that your call makes possible, that KALW is committed to. And so this is a great time. If you value that, if when you hear these conversations, you have your sense that, like, your heart and your brain start working at the same time, now is a time to call and give your support. We do have Tamara Drought's new book, Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America, yours for a $120 contribution when you call 800-525-9917 or go online to KALW.org. And, Rose, I want to let folks know that at any level of support, they will be helping us reach a challenge that has been put forward by two listeners. Patricia Yanawine in Berkeley, great supporter of your call.
Thank you.
Also, Masaru Fisher in San Francisco, KALW supporter. They've said if 15 people will support KALW in this hour, an additional $750 will come from them to this station. We thank them both. We would love to thank you. 800-525-9917.
Thank you so much for your support. 800-525-9917. You can also go online to kalw.org. We are so committed to bringing these shows to the air and opening up the phone lines. I mean, Ruby had so much anger and sadness in her voice. We had another caller. It's up on my list here.
June. Speaking at the end, I was just
right.
Like, wow.
June. Oh, yeah. June was amazing. I mean, this is what I love about this show because, I mean, what I said at the beginning, I love the stats, but I also love the real stories. And we have time for that thanks to your support. We have an hour to really dig into these issues. And that is what you support by calling 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. You know that we live in a soundbite culture, and there's a place for that. That's fine. But we need more than soundbites. I mean, an hour to dive into these issues, to take phone calls, to hear about. I mean, June said she's been doing employment services for 35 years.
Well, Rosa, and the thing is, it's of course, the hour is incredibly important.
Yeah.
And as you pointed out, there's much more to talk about with Tamara Drought. If folks want to dig deeper, they can go to her book, Sleeping Giant. We're happy to offer that as a thanks. But the thing that your call does and that I'm appreciated about you and your team is that you follow through on these ideas. You connect from one day to the next. Robert McChesney, who was on talking about automation, its impact, you brought that into this conversation because really when it comes to the economy, when it comes to social change and social justice, these are ongoing conversations. We add to our knowledge together. One person at a time supports this resource that's here for everyone. KALW.org, 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917 or online at kalw.org. And you're right, Matt, because tomorrow we're going to speak with Matthew Desmond about his new book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. And he interviewed people who cannot pay their rent and they're being evicted. I mean, these are the types of issues we need to keep talking about in order for them to change. 800-525-9917 or online at kalw.org.
A click is as good as a call as we push toward this challenge that we have before us. It means every single contribution at any level. We've had folks in this hour give $25. We have Sleeping Giant, Tamara Braddock's new book, yours for a $120 contribution. We've had folks today give $500. What it's about is participation. We understand generosity is not about how many dollars you give. It's about how committed you are and what you decide to take part in. We ask you now, if this is a service you value and you want to see it grow, we've been here for 75 years. This is a moment when you can say, I want to put something down on this local public radio station that serves me and that brings me conversations that are important. 800-525-9917. We're keeping these breaks short. We'll be going to the BBC in just a moment here on KALW San Francisco. So we ask you to get involved right now.
800-525-9917. Thanks to all of you who are calling and clicking. We've got a challenge, as Matt said, and I'm sure we're probably almost there.
We're moving there.
We're moving there. You can also go online to kalw.org.
800-525-9917. Every call or click that happens until 5 after the hour counts toward this challenge.